This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear about the third annual Michigan Autism Conference, being held October 7th through the 9th in Kalamazoo. But first, in the fall of 2002, a group of activists were protesting the U.S. going to war in Iraq. It was a group made up mostly of women, and when they chose a name for their group, they settled on one that played on the color-coded system used by the Homeland Security Department to warn against possible terrorist attacks. Code Pink was launched. One of its founders was Medea Benjamin. On October 9th, she will give the keynote address to kick off Kalamazoo College's Global Prize for Transformative Social Justice Leadership Weekend. Medea Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So Code Pink is about to become a teenager, almost 13 years old. As you look back over that time, what do you think that you have accomplished? And do you think that things are better now? Or are they worse?
Things are worse in terms of the picture in the Middle East with the extremism spreading throughout the region and into Northern Africa. The situation in Syria and Iraq is terrible. On the other hand, there are glimmers of hope in the fact that there is this Iran nuclear deal that's been reached, the opening between the U.S. and Cuba that changed a 50-plus-year-old stalemate. And I think the U.S. government searching more for diplomatic solutions is a positive one. So there's good and bad.
Specifically on the Iran nuclear deal, you have been a pretty outspoken supporter. Why do you think that this is the best way for the United States going forward?
Well, if you look at the military interventions, they have been disastrous. When I spoke about the spread of extremism throughout the Middle East, let's put that in the context of over 13 years of U.S. military response in the region, and I would say it's the U.S. intervention in Iraq that opened the gates of hell, leading the way to the groups like ISIL. So that certainly has not worked. On the other hand, when nations sit down and talk and come up with negotiated solutions, that's got a much better chance of achieving peace and achieving a more global understanding than the military intervention has. So I'm very excited about the Iran nuclear deal because not only does it avert an immediate crisis with Iran, but we already see the aftermath, which is the U.S. is talking to Iran about how we can work together to solve the crisis in Syria. So if you get together the adversaries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, the U.S. and Russia, and all have them talking about how to deal with ISIL, there's a much better chance of coming up with a real solution there.
If someone goes and searches your name on Google or perhaps looks in YouTube, they will find you debating Senator Ted Cruz back in the summer over the Iran nuclear deal. There's one point in the video where you say that trust isn't really at the center of this, it's verification. And I suppose this might be where a critic could say, well, the verification's not strong enough. What leads you to believe that the verification is sufficient for ensuring that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon going forward, or that there won't be further military entanglements?
This is the strongest verification system that's ever been set up by the IAEA, which is the entity that does the verification. I think that me and Ted Cruz and your listeners, and I don't know about you, but we're probably not experts on nuclear issues, but I think we should leave it up to the experts. And the fact that the major nations of the world, the U.S. and China and Russia, England, France, sat down with Iran, came up with a deal that the nuclear agency is going to regulate, I think we should celebrate that.
They are developing nuclear weapons. There is no doubt about it.
Absolutely false. Okay. They say that there's a lobby against nuclear weapons and that they're developing nuclear energy.
Ma'am, I did not interrupt you.
Certainly the alternative is a path to disaster. And I think that we have to trust these international agencies that they will do a good job.
Your most recent book is on drones, drone warfare, killing by remote control, which warns against the growing use of these unmanned aircraft, which can be used for military purposes, of course, for killing, for shooting down on the ground. What is the thing that you say makes drones lead to the U.S. being less safe as a result of their use?
I think the entire world is less safe because of the use of drones. I think it brings into the panoply of weapons one that is extremely dangerous because one side is sitting in safety back in their home country and pressing buttons that are killing people thousands of miles away on the mistaken notion that this technology is so good that it can pinpoint the militants, the extremists, the enemy, and kill them. And if you just keep doing that enough, you will wipe out that enemy. The reality is much more complex and much different. In fact, if you look just at the case of Yemen, where the Obama administration has been using the drones since 2009, there are more groups affiliated with extremist organizations than when we started. And while Obama had touted in an address to the nation last year that Yemen as a good example of how we're using the drones, Yemen is now a disaster case. So the drones have not in any instance eliminated the conflict. I think it just adds in an element, an international element, to what are often local conflicts that make people then turn and look at the United States as the one who killed their loved one and got involved in an internal issue, often a sectarian conflict, and internationalized it and made people hate us, where we wouldn't have been involved if we had not been using the drones.
If you look back through the history of military force, you could probably say that almost every generation has brought along something which makes it easier to kill people from further away. Guns can fire much further now than they used to be able to. We've had the development of cruise missiles and other things. You know, planes can drop bombs from very far away and they can do great damage. Do you see drones as an additional step beyond that? Is it part of the natural progression, or does drones to you represent getting into a different facet of war, which is more dangerous than perhaps those other advances previously?
Well, certainly nuclear weapons are more dangerous than drones because they can annihilate the whole world. Drones, I would put more on the progression of weapons, but I would say that they have particular elements. For example, the fact that drones can hover over villages for long periods of time and terrify the entire village. Many people say that it's a form of collective punishment, just like cluster munitions that stay in the ground and kill and maim civilians long after the fighting has stopped. So I think we have to look at this particular weapon, but we have to look at the larger issue of warfare and militarization of our planet and what can we do to roll that back and use technologies like drones for positive things, tracking endangered species, trying to help us deal with the climate crisis, predicting weather, firefighting, those kind of things, and not for killing each other.
You mentioned earlier perhaps having to take a broader look at the idea of military intervention and use of force. As someone who is a member of a group obviously committed to peace in the United States and someone who's been a longtime activist in this realm, do you see times or do you acknowledge times where the security interests of the United States or perhaps humanitarian concerns for people in other countries do justify military action?
Well, I believe that our military should be defending us here at home and should be stopping us from being attacked. But unfortunately, I think in the last 14 years, our military has created more enemies than it has stopped. I think that there are times when military force might be justified. I think we should minimize that. And while the United Nations is meeting now, I think of all the energy and the money and the efforts that could and should be spent into finding alternatives to militarism, and that's everything from providing opportunities from young people who see no options, and even here in the United States, look towards joining the military as a way to get something as simple as a college education, to refining the tools of nonviolent conflict resolution, peace and reconciliation commissions, all kinds of ways to help people get over the trauma of sectarian warfare or divisions or all of the consequences that come out of military intervention. So I think we need to minimize militarism and maximize the alternative.
Let me ask you a little bit about the political realities which enter into some of these questions. You took some heat from people on the left back in 2004 saying that you would vote for any Democrat over George W. Bush, where some people were still urging votes for the Green Party and others. You have said now that since President Obama has been in office, that a lot of the steam has gone out of the anti-war movement. So how do you find the right place where the anti-war movement holds leaders accountable, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, or whatever?
Very, very good question. I think that I have learned over these last years that what's important is to build up a movement that is separate from political parties. I was quite shocked myself when, after Obama came in, so many people who had been involved in the anti-war movement just disappeared. I thought that they understood that it was important to keep the movement going. But for any number of reasons, and one of those being that a lot of the people that we were working with were really committed to the Democratic Party and thought a Democrat was going to change things, where I was committed to the issues and assumed that so were most of my colleagues. So I think the big lesson is that no matter who is in power, a peace movement has to be independent from those political forces. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. The fact that the peace movement disappeared when Obama came in allowed Obama to build up the drone warfare, become the drone president. And I do credit Obama for having done the Iran nuclear deal and the Cuba diplomatic efforts. Those came 7 years into his presidency. And think of what we could have done if we had kept up the pressure that we had built under Bush and used it to put pressure on Obama.
Do you see any chance for reaching some common ground with members of the Republican Party now who have expressed some misgivings about previous foreign policy ventures and have said perhaps that, I mean, for instance, many of the candidates running for president have said the Iraq war was a mistake. There are other Republicans who would probably go further than that in terms of the U.S.'s military footprint. Do you see some opportunity to form some alliances there? And does that get you closer to that idea of focusing on the issue as opposed to political parties?
I think it's always important to reach out to Republicans and try to get them on board. Unfortunately, there's been such a partisan rancor. The atmosphere is so polluted in Washington that more recently, when you get Republicans, it's because they want to put a stick in Obama's eye rather than they really care about the issue. This is what I've found. Now, there are exceptions to that. There are people like Congressman Walter Jones, a very wonderful, thoughtful man who has been against a lot of the militarism because he's seen the results of going to the funerals of young people in his district. So I think it's important to reach out. Rand Paul used to have very good positions. In fact, we brought him flowers and chocolates and were applauding him when he was doing the filibuster around the drones. I don't understand why when he joined the presidential race, he felt it was important to move towards the more militaristic positions, because I think his positions actually have a lot of resonance among many people in the Republican Party, especially the young people. So, yes, I would say reaching out is a good thing to do, and that is something that we tried very hard to do around Iran. Unfortunately, the Republicans all were in lockstep on that one, even though I think a number of them knew better and knew this deal was a good thing for the country and the globe.
If someone wants to see an example of you attempting to hold President Obama accountable, they can certainly find an interesting YouTube clip where you interrupted him while he was speaking to question him on issues such as Guantanamo and on drones. Why did you decide that at that moment you were going to make your voice heard in that way with the president?
I had managed to get into the Defense University where he was giving that talk, and I was really anxious to hear it because there were rumors that this was going to be a significant policy change, that he was going to make some new initiative about Guantanamo, make some new initiative about the drones, to put us in step with our values as a nation and with international law, which is against holding people indefinitely without trial, as we've been doing in Guantanamo, and something more in line with international law instead of the drones that don't give people any chance for a trial. I waited until the end of the speech, and when he started talking about Guantanamo, he said, well, this is his last point. I knew the speech was almost over. He hadn't made any significant policy changes, and I felt upset about that.
You know, I think that the, and I'm going off script as you might expect here.
I had come back recently from both Yemen and Pakistan, where I'd met with people whose loved ones had been killed by U.S. drones by, quote, mistake. I met with people in Yemen whose loved ones had been rotting in Guantanamo for over a decade with absolutely no trials. In fact, they had been found that they had done nothing wrong, were cleared for release, but still weren't released. So I felt it was important to speak up on their behalf for people who would never get a chance to address the president.
The voice of that woman is worth paying attention to.
And the fact that he said this voice of this woman is worth listening to, I think the things that I said actually resonated with Obama himself.
When you have the president react in that way, it says your voice is worth listening to, or when Senator Ted Cruz takes 20-some minutes to go back and forth with you on the Iran deal, do you think that makes the case for this sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, confrontational style that Code Pink sometimes enforces of interrupting a hearing or a rally or a speech? Is that why you do it, to get the back and forth with the politician?
We do it really out of desperation. If we were successful in other ways, we wouldn't do it. For example, around Iran, we worked very hard with many groups around the country to mobilize people, to get them to visit their congresspeople, to go to town hall meetings, to talk, to dialogue. And that worked, which is fabulous. But that is an exception. A lot of times our political system doesn't really work for us, and we can't get our voices out. And the only way to do that is to engage in the more confrontational kind of mode. So I think because these are life and death issues, that we have to use every tool, nonviolent tool, at our disposal, which sometimes might seem to people as rude, interrupting. But when you just come from a place like Yemen and you find that a drone has just killed the 17-year-old son of a woman that you meet with, that is beyond rude. That is just totally unacceptable.
We're addressing that, ma'am.
We are responsible as citizens for the actions of our government. And when our government deals in the world with this idea of might makes right, and because we're the most powerful nation on earth, we can do things like kill people or hold them indefinitely without obeying international law, we've got to find every way we can to speak up and object to that.
Nadia Benjamin, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Nadia Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink. On October 9th, she'll give the keynote address to kick off Kalamazoo College's Global Prize Transformative Social Justice Leadership Weekend.